Before the service, my mother's siblings began to gather at their childhood home. They were my aunts and uncles, but some of them I hadn't seen since I was a child. My Uncle Daryl, who I barely knew, suggested that his brothers and sisters should spend an afternoon together at a favorite restaurant in Lava Hot Springs. My mother refused to come. She would not go without my father, and he would have nothing to do with Angie. It was a bright May afternoon when we all piled into a large van and set off on the hour-long drive. I was uncomfortably aware that I had taken my mother's place, going with her siblings and her remaining parent on an outing to remember her mother, a grandmother I had not known well. I soon realized that my not knowing her was wonderful for her children, who were bursting with remembrances and loved answering questions about her. With every story, my grandmother came into sharper focus, but the woman taking shape from their collective memories was nothing like the woman I remembered. It was then I realized how cruelly I had judged her, how my perception of her had been distorted because I'd been looking at her through my father's harsh lens. During the drive back, my Aunt Debbie invited me to visit her in Utah. My Uncle Daryl echoed her. "We'd love to have you in Arizona," he said. In the space of a day, I had reclaimed a family. Not mine, hers. The funeral was the next day. I stood in a corner and watched my siblings trickle in. There were Tyler and Stephanie. They had decided to homeschool their 7 children, and from what I'd seen, the children were being educated to a very high standard. Luke came in next, with a brood so numerous I lost count. He saw me and crossed the room, and we made small talk for several minutes, neither of us acknowledging that we hadn't seen each other in half a decade, neither of us alluding to why. "Do you believe what Dad says about me?" I wanted to ask. "Do you believe I'm dangerous?" But I didn't. Luke worked for my parents, and without an education, he needed that job to support his family. Forcing him to take a side would only end in heartache. Richard, who was finishing a PhD in chemistry, had come down from Oregon with Cammy and their children. He smiled at me from the back of the chapel. A few months before, Richard had written to me. He'd said he was sorry for believing Dad, that he wished he'd done more to help me when I needed it, and that from then on, I could count on his support. "We were family," he said. Audrey and Benjamin chose a bench near the back. Audrey had arrived early, when the chapel was empty. She had grabbed my arm and whispered that my refusing to see our father was a grave sin. "He is a great man," she said. "For the rest of your life, you will regret not humbling yourself and following his counsel." These were the first words my sister had said to me in years, and I had no response to them. Sean arrived a few minutes before the service, with Emily and Peter and a little girl I had never met. It was the first time I had been in a room with him since the night he'd killed Diego. I was tense, but there was no need. He did not look at me once during the service. My oldest brother, Tony, sat with my parents, his 5 children fanning out in the pew. Tony had a GED and had built a successful trucking company in Las Vegas, but it hadn't survived the recession. Now he worked for my parents, as did Sean and Luke and their wives, as well as Audrey and her husband Benjamin. Now I thought about it, I realized that all my siblings, except Richard and Tyler, were economically dependent on my parents. My family was splitting down the middle, the 3 who had left the mountain and the 4 who had stayed, the 3 with doctorates and the 4 without high school diplomas. A chasm had appeared and was growing. A year would pass before I would return to Idaho. A few hours before my flight from London, I wrote to my mother, as I always did, as I always will do, to ask if she would see me. Again, her response was swift. She would not, she would never, unless I would see my father. To see me without him, she said, would be to disrespect her husband. For a moment, it seemed pointless, this annual pilgrimage to a home that continued to reject me, and I wondered if I should go. Then I received another message, this one from Aunt Angie. She said Grandpa had canceled his plans for the next day and was refusing even to go to the temple as he usually did on Wednesdays, because he wanted to be at home in case I came by. To this, Angie added, I get to see you in about 12 hours, but who's counting? Chapter 40. Educated. When I was a child, I waited for my mind to grow, for my experiences to accumulate and my choices to solidify, taking shape into the likeness of a person. That person, or that likeness of one, had belonged. I was of that mountain, the mountain that had made me. It was only as I grew older that I wondered if how I had started is how I would end, if the first shape a person takes is their only true shape. As I write the final words of this story, I've not seen my parents in years, since my grandmother's funeral. I'm close to Tyler, Richard, and Tony, and from them, as well as from other family, I hear of the ongoing drama on the mountain, the injuries, violence, and shifting loyalties. But it comes to me now as distant hearsay, which is a gift. I don't know if the separation is permanent, if one day I will find a way back, but it has brought me peace. That peace did not come easily. I spent 2 years enumerating my father's flaws, constantly updating the tally, as if reciting every resentment, every real and imagined act of cruelty, of neglect, would justify my decision to cut him from my life. Once justified, I thought the strangling guilt would release me, and I could catch my breath. But vindication has no power over guilt. No amount of anger or rage directed at others can subdue it, because guilt is never about them. Guilt is the fear of one's own wretchedness. It has nothing to do with other people. I shed my guilt when I accepted my decision on its own terms, without endlessly prosecuting old grievances, without weighing his sins against mine, without thinking of my father at all. I learned to accept my decision for my own sake, because of me, not because of him, because I needed it, not because he deserved it. It was the only way I could love him. When my father was in my life, wrestling me for control of that life, I perceived him with the eyes of a soldier, through a fog of conflict. I could not make out his tender qualities. When he was before me, towering, indignant, I could not remember how, when I was young, his laugh used to shake his gut and make his glasses shine. In his stern presence, I could never recall the pleasant way his lips used to twitch before they were burned away, when a memory tugged tears from his eyes. I can only remember those things now, with a span of miles and years between us. But what has come between me and my father is more than time or distance. It is a change in the self. I am not the child my father raised, but he is the father who raised her. If there was a single moment when the breach between us, which had been cracking and splintering for 2 decades, was at last too vast to be bridged, I believe it was that winter night when I stared at my reflection in the bathroom mirror while, without my knowing it, my father grasped the phone in his knotted hands and dialed my brother. Diego, the knife. What followed was very dramatic, but the real drama had already played out in the bathroom. It had played out when, for reasons I don't understand, I was unable to climb through the mirror and send out my 16-year-old self in my place. Until that moment, she had always been there, no matter how much I appeared to have changed, how illustrious my education, how altered my appearance, I was still her. At best, I was two people, a fractured mind. She was inside, and emerged whenever I crossed the threshold of my father's house. That night, I called on her, and she didn't answer. She left me. She stayed in the mirror. The decisions I made after that moment were not the ones she would have made. They were the choices of a changed person, a new self. You could call this selfhood many things: transformation, metamorphosis, falsity, betrayal. I call it an education. This is Julia Whalen. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Educated, a Memoir by Tara Westover. This program was directed by Kim Smith. Executive producer, Diane McKiernan. Text copyright 2018 by Tara Westover. Production copyright 2018 Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.